team lifts its siege. The Palestinians say the Israeli regime's repeated attacks on the positions of the resistance in Gaza would not dissuade them from fighting for their freedom and dignity. Over the Israeli regime's tight blockade, which now includes deliberate hampering of efforts to reconstruct the strip following its latest war on Gaza. Back in May, the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups fired around 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war, forcing Tel Aviv to call for a ceasefire.
The only way it really works with this particular regime, and this illegitimate regime, the Zionist regime, is by righteous, unified resistance, and that's exactly what we want to see in Palestine.
Amid the ongoing confrontations, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz met in Ramallah on Sunday, marking the highest level meeting held between the two sides in over a decade. The two discussed issues related to diplomacy, economics, and civil affairs, according to a statement from Gantz's office.
You know, it's quite clear that the Zionist regime does not want peace and does not want to recognize the Palestinians, because they had a chance many times. You can see that they're still stealing, you know, areas in the West Bank, and that's obviously international law breaches. We can see now, you know, Sheikh Jarrah, Sinwan, all these different areas, even in Jerusalem, in different areas, they're still, you know, evicting, stealing people's homes in a very, very barbaric way.
The Palestinian resistance groups have pledged not to allow the Israeli regime to continue its aggression against the Palestinian people or change the rules of engagement.
Thousands of activists gathered nationwide to commemorate the 58th anniversary of Martin Luther King's Voting Equality March in Washington on Saturday. They protested against curbs to voting access in some Republican-led states that rights groups say disproportionately affect people of color. Many activists view the fight over voting rules as the civil rights issue of the era. In Washington, about 20,000 marchers held Black Lives Matter flags and signs and called on Congress to bolster voter rights. Other rallies were planned in Phoenix, Miami, and several other U.S. cities. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, a nonprofit public policy institute, for this year at least 18 states have adopted a total of 30 restrictive election laws, with dozens of others under consideration. Those laws range from a requirement to have a fixed address in order to register the vote to a ban on the drive-through voting that was popular in some states last year amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The organizers of Saturday's protests denounced the legislation as racist, anti-democratic voter suppression laws and demanded that the U.S. Congress pass legislation to block such voting restrictions. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden admitted that the recent push in Republican-controlled states to restrict voting access is in contrast with fair and free elections.
There's an unfolding assault taking place in America today, an attempt to suppress and subvert the right to vote in fair and free elections.
The Democratic-controlled House of Representatives has passed two draft laws to limit voting restrictions. But in the closely divided Senate, Republicans have promised to block voting rights legislation. This is a sign of polarization in the U.S. Congress.
Well, I think you have to look at it in the context of the United States political sphere. I don't think voting or our system in the United States is particularly democratic from the very onset. You have to keep in mind that when the United States Constitution was first written, first ratified, you know, only white male property owners were able to vote or have any say in public discourse. And unfortunately, not too much has changed. You know, maybe there's a little bit more people of color, maybe there's a little bit more women, but the property owning part is largely still in effect, because you have the average income of elected officials at the federal level is so high. I don't think most people in the United States feel represented by their elected officials. I don't think they think our country is going in the right direction.
American society is plagued with racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group, as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. On Saturday, thousands of people demonstrated in the U.S. capital, Washington, and in several cities across the country to demand voting rights protection.
Our country is backsliding to the unconscionable days of Jim Crow. And some of our senators are saying, well, we can't overcome the filibuster. Then I say to you today, get rid of the filibuster. That is the monument to slavery we must dismantle. That is the monument to white supremacy we must tear down.
I march because I'm tired of elected officials putting themselves first. To be honest, I am disgusted by the behavior of many of our leaders. In this country, it's easier to register to own a gun than it is to register to vote. Think about that. If you are a congressperson protecting firearms, why won't you protect the right to vote? That is completely unacceptable. I march because I want change, not just for me, but for everyone who comes next.
While some marchers carried posters supporting the end of the filibuster, others chanted about police violence toward black people, workers' rights, the Afghanistan withdrawal, and minimum wage. This is a clear message that voting rights were not the only issue in people's minds.
In the limelight.
Jacob Chansley, who stormed onto the U.S. Senate floor in face paint and a horned hat, accepted a deal under which federal prosecutors will recommend a sentence of 41 to 51 months in prison. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Alan Fuhrer. The piece is titled Capital Rioter Known as QAnon Shaman Pleads Guilty. Jacob Chansley, who stormed onto the U.S. Senate floor in face paint and a horned hat, accepted a deal under which federal prosecutors will recommend a sentence of 41 to 51 months in prison. Jacob Chansley, a former actor and U.S. Navy sailor, widely known as the QAnon Shaman, who stormed the Capitol building in January in Stars and Stripes face paint and a horned fur hat, pleaded guilty on Friday, 3rd of September, to a single felony count of obstructing an official proceeding before Congress. Mr. Chansley, a 34-year-old, became one of the best-known figures in the Capitol breach after images of him standing shirtless on the U.S. Senate floor, brandishing a spear made from a flagpole, shot around the globe, vividly representing the role played in the riot by adherents of QAnon, the cult-like conspiracy theory embraced by some backers of former President Donald J. Trump. Mr. Chansley, who says he has now lost faith in Donald Trump, remained in the spotlight even after his arrest. In February, his lawyer, Albert Watkins, persuaded a federal judge to order the jail where Chansley was being detained to provide him with a strict diet of organic meals. The next month, Jacob Chansley gave a widely watched interview to 60 Minutes, saying that his actions on 6th of January were not an attack on the nation, but rather a way to bring God back into the Senate. His plea hearing in Federal District Court in Washington on Friday, 3rd of September, departed from the circus-like atmosphere that has surrounded the case from the start. He did not speak other than to answer yes or no procedural questions. Under the terms of his deal, Jacob Chansley agreed to accept a recommended 41 to 51 months in prison. He is scheduled to be sentenced on 17th of November. Another defendant who pleaded guilty to the same charge this year was given 8 months at a sentencing hearing back in July. Among the first rioters to break into the Capitol building, Jacob Chansley was arrested 3 days later and charged with civil disorder, obstruction, disorderly conduct in a restricted building, and demonstrating in a Capitol building. Prosecutors say that whilst he was in the Senate chamber, he left a note on the desk of Vice President at the time Mike Pence, saying, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming." Jacob Chansley, who had appeared in his shaman costume at several pro-Trump rallies before 6th of January, was also one of the first defendants to blame Donald Trump for his own behavior at the riot. A few weeks after Mr. Chansley's arrest, his lawyer Albert Watkins said former President Donald Trump was culpable of inciting his followers to attack the Capitol building, adding that he planned to ask the White House for a pardon for his client. "Does our president bear responsibility?" Mr. Watkins told the New York Times at the time. "Oh, yes, he does." More recently, however, Albert Watkins has said that Jacob Chansley, like other rioters, felt betrayed by former President Donald Trump. He also said that Chansley has repudiated the QAnon cult and would like to be known merely as a shaman, not the QAnon shaman. The path charted by Jacob Chansley since 6th of January has been a process, one which has involved pain, depression, solitary confinement, introspection, recognition of mental health vulnerabilities, and a coming to grips with the need for more self-work, Albert Watkins, his lawyer, said in a statement on Thursday, 2nd of September. At a news conference after the hearing, Albert Watkins told reporters that Jacob Chansley had been under pressure from his family not to plead guilty. His family, Mr. Watkins said, believed that former President Donald Trump was going to be reinstated as president and could issue Mr. Chansley a pardon, a baseless theory of the sort once promoted by QAnon that continues to circulate among some Trump supporters. "It took a lot of courage for a young man who was raised by his mother to say no," Albert Watkins said. With Jacob Chansley's plea, 51 of the roughly 600 people who have been charged in connection with the Capitol riot have entered guilty pleas, most for misdemeanor offenses like disorderly conduct. At least another 11 defendants are scheduled to plead guilty by the end of October.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Tour the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Greetings, dear brothers and sisters, and welcome to Youth Station, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio Station. Brother Habib at your service, and the other co-host is...
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and other life forms. Because we have numerous narrations talking about how everything in the samawat and in the ard, everything in the skies... and the earth mourned and cried for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam. So whether you're an alien or a jinn or an inanimate object or angels, whatever you are, you can relate to the topics we're discussing during these days because they're about Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and his profound movement. So what you got for me today, bro?
I personally believe that the Arab, or you could say the Middle East, you know, it's like putting the Persians and put the Afghans and...
the Urdu-speaking communities.
Yes.
The Turks. Let's not forget the Turks.
Yes. I believe that we commemorated the memory of Imam Hussein alayhi salam way better than other people.
Define other people.
I'm talking about the West.
Oh, you're racist. You.
Yeah.
No, I have to agree with you. God, English eulogies are so cringy.
That's the thing. You know...
Look. English is my first language, okay?
All right.
When it comes to other arenas, I can relate to them better through English, whether it's a movie, it's a book, it's a lecture. But when it comes to eulogies, or what they call litmias, in English, oh my God, no. I want to like pour acid in my ears.
There are some poems, however, that are not that bad.
Or spoken words.
Spoken words
are good.
That's the thing. There are two different ways I've seen, you know, that work. Tried it as well. To make people cry when you're doing a majlis.
In English?
In Arabic, in English. Let's say in Arabic. The na'i parts, where you have special tones, specific tones, specific manners. And my voice is not that beautiful, so I'm not good at it. There's also the second part, the way that you speak.
Definitely.
The tragedy that you bring up, the way that you analyze it, makes people cry.
And I think Arabic is a more eloquent language. That's why the Quran was sent in that language, in that specific language, right? It's such a rich language, literature-wise, eloquence-wise. And it's so, you can fit so many concepts into one word. And that's what makes it so much cooler than all the other languages. But I think to a great extent, it's culture, too. This method of litmias or eulogies or musliba or whatever you want to call it, or in Farsi they call it droze, it's the culture of the Middle East, right? So naturally, it fits their language. But if you want to do English, you can't put it into this mold anymore. You got to use English in a sort of mold, a frame that fits their language and culture. That's why I feel like spoken words... works very well.
Very good, yeah, in English.
In English, can you imagine spoken word in Arabic or Turkish?
In Arabic, there are some, actually there is, and I've seen it in some lectures, the way that they bring up the story, the way that they talk about the story, and it affects you, it makes you cry. But that's just one way of, you know, remembering Imam Hussein. That's just one way of keeping the memory alive. There are different ways. What other different ways do us Shia
do? My least favorite way is that the little theatrical act people put up. They dress as the Ahlul Bayt and the enemies, and they reenact the scenes. That's my least favorite.
Why is it your least favorite?
I hate it.
Why do you hate it?
Your least favorite is not a strong enough word. I despise it.
Why?
Number one, what are you doing? Number two, why are you doing it?
Really?
Number three, just stop. I feel like it's so degrading.
I want to defend about it. I want to defend it. First of all, yes. Second of all,
for the listeners, I just need to say, Brother Habib just stuck his phone in my face and showed a picture of himself and a bunch of his homies dressed up in...
getting ready to go to a play.
Yeah, costumes, going to a play to reenact the events of Karbala. Okay, go ahead and defend.
Second of all, there's this book called Nasrat al-Mazlum.
Okay.
All right. Sheikh Hassan al-Muzaffar. And the reason that he made this book was that there was this Sayyid available in al-Basra talking smack about, you know, acting and doing plays. There's this book about it. It's called Nasrat al-Mazlum. Inshallah ta'ala will be translated. Allahumma wafiqna. Thirdly, what's wrong with it?
I feel like it's degrading for the Ahlul Bayt.
Why?
Because it is.
It makes people cry.
So?
We had two episodes before.
Talking about the importance
of crying.
Look. Just because it's a door.
It's a way. It's a method of making people cry.
Just because it's important for people to cry doesn't mean that we should achieve that through any means possible.
Why do you limit it?
Because there are principles. Everything is about principles. All right,
what principle makes you limit the way that we make people cry?
Dude, it's like common sense, number one. Number one, it's common sense. Number two...
What common sense are you talking about?
When you tell, like, a lot of the ulama, I don't know if you guys...
Sheikh al-Na'ini, what ulama bigger than the Sheikh al-Na'ini? The teacher of all these that are available right now, the teacher's teachers, has a fatwa telling people, recommending people to go do such things. All right, go ahead. What common sense are you talking about?
I don't know if you guys have watched the series that came out. I think it was... Good tenure. When did this?
Mukhtar?
Yeah.
Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. I don't know. It's been like 6-7 years.
The production itself took 8 years. But you remember when Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas was supposed to be portrayed by this really beautiful actor?
They stated that don't put the face.
Do you remember or not?
They stated
do
don't
you
put
remember?
The face. Yes.
You do remember. Okay, yeah. That's it. That's all I wanted to say. Okay. Moving on.
Not all of them. We haven't finished.
Mourning. No, let's talk about. There are different concepts.
I'm sorry. This is important. This is important to me. All right? So you say that common sense. What common sense are you talking about? Where did you get your common sense? And who stated that your common sense that you, sister, have is something that makes us want to limitate the way that we make people cry?
Hey, it's my personal opinion.
Keep it to yourself. I'm sorry, but don't block the way of people crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. I don't know. That's all I want to say. Your common sense. It's a way of making people cry. Some people don't cry with your cat-like voices. I don't know what to do with them. I go act and do a play about it.
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you're listening to Youth Station here on IRB English Radio. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
لبيك يا حسين لبيك يا
Thank you for joining us again. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Zainab and my co-host...
Brother Habib at your service.
Talking about different concepts of mourning, poetry. But I want to hear more about people's different experiences. Hey, you've had different experiences with different cultures, right?
Yeah.
And their mourning ceremonies.
Yeah.
Which one did you enjoy the most?
I really personally like the mornings of where you sit down and they talk about Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and they start to do na'i, and then you start to cry.
Yeah, that's good.
I like also just reading the narrations.
Mm.
There's this...
like the maqatir?
No. Like, for example, we open Kamal Ziyarat, a book by Ibn Qawlaway. And, for example, this happened and this happened. And that by itself makes us tear.
Yeah, definitely.
That's enough for me to make me start wanting to cry. If I want to go to the extreme and you want to go drive me crazy with the things that Imam Hussein al-Islam went to, then there are history books that, you know, go into detail of what happened. Till this day, I haven't heard it completely.
Mm-hmm.
and I don't want to hear it completely.
Exactly.
Because I know what happened, and it's enough for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And definitely. Going into details is too, you know, hard for me.
Yeah, and it's especially important to adhere at the end of the day to the way the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam themselves mourned Imam al-Hussein, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the methods we see today, I don't know, I sometimes feel like they're missing the point. I don't know if you've been into certain countries, especially in the subcontinent, certain regions of it where they begin the mourning ceremonies for Abu Abdullah and they bedazzle the whores. And haven't you seen it?
What did they do?
They bedazzle the whores. They put perfume on the horse and lots of flowers and flags. And I don't know, it's supposed to reenact Dhul Jannah or something. And people become so obsessed. See, Imam al-Hussein is so kareem. He's so noble. He's so generous. That the smallest movement you make, you do in his direction, he will multiply it and he will use it as an excuse to grant you salvation in the hereafter. Right. Right? Because that's the whole point of Imam al-Hussein. But sometimes I feel that the son of the Prophet of Allah and the Hujjah of Allah upon this earth didn't just die for me to bedazzle a horse. You know what I mean?
It's a method. It's a way. Of course, there's better methods.
Exactly.
If that's what you're trying to say, there are better methods. Then, of course, there are methods. It's
like,
their
you
way.
Know what I especially love? Who is Hussein? Do you know the campaign?
The charity organization, yeah.
Isn't it wonderful? If you're going to commemorate someone, commemorate them like that. They help the poor, the needy, everything, clothing, food, medication, blood, shelter, sometimes stationery.
In the name of Imam Hussein.
In the name of Imam Hussein.
That's beautiful, yeah.
That is beautiful. And not, they don't even restrict themselves to Muharram and Safar and Muslims and Shias, to everyone. And that's gorgeous, because that's what Imam al-Hussein is. He's for all of humanity. He's for boys and girls, brothers and sisters, other life forms.
The life forms I might accept. Yes, continue, sister.
My favorite mourning ceremony on Arba'in one year. And I don't cry very easily. I cry twice a year, Muharram and Safar. I cry long, but just twice, right? But when I saw this scene, I broke down. It was a congregation, a group of people who were mute and deaf. And their mullah basically was standing there doing musibah for them in sign language. Talking about it now gives me goosebumps. And certain gestures, you don't have to know sign language, you just understand it. Like little baby, like slaughter, like thirsty, like horse. And you saw it and you saw the way this man was expressing the events of Karbala with his entire body, using his face, his hands, his shoulders, signs, actual signs. And that was one of the most captivating mourning ceremonies I've ever witnessed, I've ever had the honor of witnessing in my life.
So that's what you liked, sign language.
Yes, silence, yes.
From the same person that, you know, doesn't like, you know, role-playing and stuff like that.
Exactly. No. What I'm saying is peace and quiet.
Oh.
Peace and quiet. That's what I like.
You know that people differ from
definitely.
The way...
Definitely, absolutely.
Cultures differ.
Yeah.
There are different ways, and you cannot limit them like you try to do.
No.
There's this... methods, Bushahri, where they, you know, they bring in specific drums and bells and whatnot.
Very epic, very epic.
Some people don't like it. Some people like it.
Mm.
I know a person who used to hate it, but now every time he hears it...
He's enchanted.
He cries.
Mm.
Becomes
what is,
sorrow.
Do you know the philosophy behind it? The drums
Look,
and the...
There are a lot of things behind it. For example, you start off with the beating the chest.
Mm-hmm.
How did it start? There's actually a documentary about it. Usually these are the drums for war, you could say.
Oh,
remembering the war.
The drums and the chimes and the cymbals.
Yeah, and also, how do you say it? It's just something that is attached to the movement of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. That the drums, they brought in fear. You know, like, I don't know if you've heard the Najafis when they do it.
Oh, yeah.
You've heard the Najafis when they do it, when they hit it real hard.
It feels like an earthquake.
You feel like your inner parts are moving and your outside is not moving.
Yeah.
So just imagine Sayyidah Zainab alayhi salam. Just imagine the daughters of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. When the army of Yazid ibn Hurr al-Riyahi stopped them in their path. Just imagine when the army of Umar ibn Sa'd wretched Karbala. How did they feel? Just that by itself makes you remind. And that by itself, if we cry our entire lives for the fact that the daughters of the Prophet
fell into fear, was
struck, it's not enough. If the world burns for this calamity by itself, it's not enough. We ask you to keep us in your prayers during these sorrow days. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala greaten your reward for in your morning towards Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you guys for joining us on Arab English Radio Station. You guys are listening to Youth Station. From now until another show, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Though a youth with high prospects, though a youth with high prospects, duties he did not neglect, abandoned hopes to protect the faith.
The limelight.
A new analysis released recently shows the United States will ultimately spend upwards of $8 trillion, and that nearly 1 million people have lost their lives so far in the so-called Global War on Terror that was launched after the attacks of September 11, 2001. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Cooley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Estimated Cost of Post-9/11 U.S. Wars Hits $8 Trillion with Nearly a Million People Dead. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. With the final U.S. troops leaving Afghanistan after nearly 20 years of occupation and war, a new analysis released recently shows the United States will ultimately spend upwards of $8 trillion, and that nearly 1 million people have lost their lives so far in the so-called Global War on Terror that was launched after the attacks of September 11, 2001. What about the people left behind in Afghanistan, in Iraq, after a drone strike in Somalia? What about them? Do they get any care? Do they get any compensation? Absolutely not. So what would be the cost of war if that was actually the priority for the United States? Dr. Maha Helal, Justice for Muslim Collective, said. According to Brown University's Cost of War Project, which has been releasing reports on the financial and human costs of the post-9/11 wars at regular intervals since 2010, the total cost of the war and military operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, and elsewhere over the last two decades have directly killed at least 897,000 to 929,000 people, an estimate the researchers say is conservative. Dr. Nita Crawford, co-director of the Cost of War Project, in a statement said, the deaths we tallied are likely a vast undercount of the true toll these wars have taken on human life. It's critical we properly account for the vast and varied consequences of the many U.S. wars and counterterror operations since 9/11, as we pause and reflect on all of the lives lost. The study calculates that of the $8 trillion estimated cost in the wars waged by the United States regime since 9/11, $2.3 trillion is attributed to the Afghanistan-Pakistan war zone, $2.1 trillion is attributed to the Iraq-Syria war zone, and $355 billion was attributed to other battlefields, including Libya, Somalia, and elsewhere. Above those figures, another $1.1 trillion was spent on homeland security programs, and $2.2 trillion is the estimated obligation for the future care of U.S. veterans who served in the various wars. Detailing the report for The Intercept, journalist Murtaza Hussein writes, "The staggering economic cost of the war on terror pale in comparison to the direct human impact measured in people killed, wounded, and driven from their homes. The cost of war project's latest estimates hold that 897,000 to 929,000 people have been killed during the wars. Of those killed, 387,000 are categorized as civilians, 207,000 as members of national military and police forces, and a further 301,000 as opposition fighters killed by U.S.-led coalition troops and their allies." The report also found that around 15,000 U.S. military service members and contractors have been killed in the wars, along with a similar number of allied Western troops deployed to the conflicts and several hundred journalists and humanitarian aid workers. The question of how many people have lost their lives in the post-9/11 conflicts has been the subject of ongoing debate, though the numbers in all cases have been extraordinarily high. Previous cost of war studies have put death toll figures in the hundreds of thousands, an estimate tallying those directly killed by violence. According to a 2015 estimate from the Nobel Prize-winning Physicians for Social Responsibility, well over 1 million have been killed both indirectly and directly in the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan alone. The difficulty of calculating death tolls is made harder by the U.S. military's own refusal to keep track of the number of people killed in its operations, as well as the remoteness of the regions where many of the conflicts take place. The researchers behind the project emphasize that while the total number of direct deaths caused by the more recent wars are less than the World Wars and the Vietnam War, the post-9/11 conflicts are different because of the long-term damage they have done to the societies and have suffered under many years of constant bombings, death, and destruction. Dr. Stephanie Sable, co-director of the project, said in a statement, "What have we truly accomplished in 20 years of post-9/11 wars and at what price? 20 years from now, we will still be reckoning with the high societal cost of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars long after U.S. forces are gone." The Cost of War Project's report arrived on the same day as a similar study unveiled by the National Priorities Project, which showed that overall spending on increased militarization both abroad and domestically in the U.S. has soared since 9/11. In that study, as Common Dreams reports separately, overall spending on increased military operations, domestic surveillance, border security is estimated at $21 trillion. An online event with the report's lead researcher, Dr. Nita Crawford, and other experts to discuss the findings of the report was held recently. Hosted by The Intercept Hussein, the panel also featured Dr. Catherine Lutz and Dr. Linda Bones of the Cost of War Project and Dr. Maha Halal of the Justice for Muslims Collective. In addition, remarks will be made by Senator Jack Reed and Representatives Barbara Lee, David Cicilline, and Ro Khanna. Speaking during the panel discussion, Dr. Halal said that the money on war spent since 9/11 is, to her, $8 trillion dedicated to the murder of Muslims, and I see no better way to make this sound any better or different. We talk about what will happen to the veterans when they come back, she continued. Obviously, that's important to address, but what about the people left behind in Afghanistan, in Iraq, after a drone struck in Somalia? What about them? Do they get any care? Do they get any compensation? Absolutely not. So what would be the cost of war if that was actually the priority for the United States? In conclusion to her remarks, Hilal quoted from the 2013 testimony of a 13-year-old boy from Pakistan named Zabir, whose family had been targeted by U.S. drones, when he told Congress, I no longer love blue skies. In fact, I now prefer gray skies. The drones do not fly when the skies are gray. This is the cost of war, Hilal said. That a young boy 13 years old can never look at the sky the same way that people who haven't been bombarded with violence can. And this, to me, is one of the things that has been totally neglected.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
What two measures did Lady Zainab take that led to Ashura's survival? January 7th, 2015. Oppressors and tyrants wanted to eliminate the event of the Husseini Ashura. But Zainab al-Kubra, God's greetings be upon her, did not allow this to happen. Our Lady Zainab al-Kubra made two moves in order to do this. One was made during her capture and her transfer to Kufa and Sham, where she made illuminating and enlightening speeches. The other move was making a pilgrimage to Karbala in Arba'in. This was either the first or second Arba'in. This move means that we should not allow the malevolent motives which intend to erase dear, influential, and important errors from memories to be successful. Of course, they will not be successful. As long as nations are alive, as long as truthful tongues speak, and as long as religious hearts are motivated, they will not be able to erase these errors and events, as they have not been successful until today. The entire life of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a lesson. June 12th, 2013. It is a glorious panorama in history which has been presented to the entire humanity. Imam Hussein alayhi salam prepared himself for such a day. Of course, the entire 50-plus-year life of Hussein ibn Ali is a lesson. His childhood is a lesson. His youth is a lesson. His behavior during his imamate is a lesson. And his behavior after the martyrdom of Imam Hassan is a lesson. It wasn't the case that Imam Hussein's responsibility was confined to the last day. However, the event of Karbala enjoys such greatness and brightness that, like a sun, it overshadows all the other lights.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum.
أنا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
أنا لا تشان
أنا لا
تشان Why are martyrs of Karbala incomparable to others? June 12, 2013. Many people were martyred in the way of God, and alongside the Holy Prophet, the Commander of the Faithful, and Divine Prophets, but none of these events is comparable to the event of Karbala. There is a difference between a person who enters the arena with the praise and encouragement of friends and companions, and with a hope of victory, and who is martyred in such conditions. And a person who enters the arena in a dark and gloomy world, while not only do all the great personalities of the world of Islam refuse to accompany him, but they also blame him for engaging in battle. The latter enters the arena while there is no hope of assistance from anyone. He enters the arena with a few sincere friends and with his family, including his wife, his sister, his nieces and nephews, his 6-month-old son and a few young members of his family. While his friends and supporters in Kufa refuse to accompany him, this is a strange event.
A house was recently bombed by a US drone strike. Shrapnels have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent US drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the US airstrike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that US brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the US for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Imal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the US airstrike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish Foreign Minister said in a joint presser with Dutch Foreign Minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said, his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse, assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People have started to feel the burden of migrants and the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
As they stood for a photograph ahead of their latest meeting on Friday, EU foreign affairs ministers appeared to be in a jovial mood. However, critics say they have little to laugh about given the West's role in the Afghan crisis. At a press conference following the meeting, it was made clear the EU is not encouraging Afghan refugees to travel to the 27-country bloc.
The own commitments of the Taliban to let people to go out if they want. It doesn't mean that we have any kind of commitment from the member states to take care of them.
That statement is likely to enrage rights groups and aid agencies. Oxfam had already published a statement accusing the EU of turning its back on Afghan refugees. European Commission data suggests 3.5 million people are currently internally displaced within the country. One in three are going hungry. 500,000 people are currently trying to leave Afghanistan, according to the Commission. EU lawmakers say it's not fair for the EU to place the responsibility of refugees on neighbouring countries like Pakistan and Iran.
Make sure that they have and they will own their migration crisis and that we stay away from that as best we can. I think that is hypocritical at best.
A coordinated strategy by the EU to the refugee crisis is urgently required, experts argue.
If the European Union was able to react, to respond to the refugee challenge collectively, the individual burden for every single country would be much lower.
The role the EU, NATO, Britain and the US played in Afghanistan has been castigated in the European Parliament.
The Americans lied to their people. The Americans spent over $2.2 trillion, and over $2 trillion of it went to private contractors.
One legislator suggests the EU misjudged the level of support that exists for the Taliban.
They obviously were appealing for many in Afghanistan, because otherwise they hadn't taken over the country so quickly.
Without assistance from the international community, European Commission officials forecast medical supplies will run out in Kabul within 2 weeks, and 120 children in the country could die every single day. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
If you live in England, chances are you're already paying more for your food. And it all begins here. Every year, tens of thousands of people come to work on UK farms from Eastern Europe. This year, the workforce is already down more than 10%. The culprit, farmers and economists say, Brexit.
We, as a farmer, are hugely passionate about employing local people, and there are many roles and career opportunities for local people here, but we simply don't have the people coming forward for the jobs.
Since Brexit, the right for EU workers to just turn up in the UK is no longer. The government quota only allows 30,000 EU labourers onto UK farms now. The industries say they need twice that number.
The cause of that shortage is a mixture of incompetence and hubris, because the British government said, oh yes, we can leave the EU, and after that everything is hunky-dory, we can rely on America.
The labor shortage is not limited to British farms only. They go across the board. The hospitality sector, for example, is 180,000 short. The meat processing sector, 5,000. When there are so many vacancies in so many different sectors in an interconnected economy, that is a problem.
One problem is in the haulage industry. Plenty of work, not enough drivers. With many waiting in long queues to take their driving tests, which stopped during COVID, creating a backlog that snowballed with Brexit, meaning the industry is now 15,000 drivers short. Some have offered a substantial pay rise for drivers to lure more people into the job. Experts say there is a problem with that.
It is far from certain that even a price rise will actually solve the solution. For a start, it's not going to bring back those EU drivers for a start. They've probably gone. So you see, the situation is bad. It doesn't look as though they can solve it at the moment. And it's going to be one of the factors of many putting up the prices very considerably in the shops.
For some industries here, COVID sent thousands of workers home. Brexit's been a big hurdle for many to come back. The one thing a post-pandemic rebound economy needs, though, is labor wherever it's from. And as long as this chronic shortage of labor exists, the average Briton will feel the pinch at the cash register. Saeed Purreza, London.
As an example of popular resistance, Palestinians held several rallies on Thursday along the separation fence. There were huge night confrontations, and Palestinians called for a complete lifting of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip as a result of the continuous gathering by the borders that has been going on for almost 2 weeks. The Israeli regime began to submit to the Palestinian pressure as a list of Palestinian demands has been implemented.
Israel's new measures and facilities are not coming for the favor of the Palestinian side as much as they come to prevent the Palestinian outrage and try to restore peace by the border. Israel is afraid of these gatherings that represent the popular resistance resulted from the deteriorating life Gazans are living. These facilitations are never enough, and Palestinians want a complete end of the siege.
During the clashes, Palestinians burned tires and threw explosives to disturb the Israeli army. The regime soldiers fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters during the nighttime clashes.
Those are not facilitations. The new decisions are simple rights of the Palestinians that the Israeli regime has deprived us of for 50 years. Palestinians are living their worst times ever, while there is no medicine, no food, and we have to take action. All spheres of Gazans are here protesting peacefully, and these protests are ongoing until all the blockade is over.
Palestinians insist on keeping the resistance, starting from nightly confusion to incendiary balloons and clashing with the Israeli regime along the borders. The Israeli regime has not yet kept up with the demands of Palestinians, including ending the Kremlin blockade. Meanwhile, the resistance